2 of tape number 2, that's side 2 of tape number 2, interview with Bud and Betty Gillies on the 2nd of November 1977. It's now 15 minutes after 7, and I probably got these people pretty tired. But we were talking about Bud. He went to work in 1934 after Loining had shut down his outfit, and he went to work for Grumman. And you, when you went to work for Grumman, you went to work as...
To work as a test pilot, primarily, but since we only had an airplane to fly every couple of weeks, they gave me a desk in the purchasing department and gave me two assignments, one to handle the Navy spare parts business, and two to handle the subcontracting of the machine parts and anodizing and heat treating services that we were subcontracting out to others. And I was involved in the production test flying of the two-seater Scouts, SF-1s, did the experimental flying on the XS-BF-1, which was to be the successor to that. The F2F1 single-seat fighter, the F3F1 single-seat fighter. And then in 1936, I really got my first main project there, which ended up being the Grumman G-21 Goose. And I sold the first five of those to a syndicate of people who wanted an airplane to commute from their homes on Long Island Sound into Wall Street in New York. And they had owned at that time either Loening Commuters or Sikorsky S-39s. And we started that using the Grumman J-2F amphibian hull and straightened the sides up, made it a cabin, put a monoplane wing on top of it with a pair of Wasp Junior engines in it.
Did you really start from the J-2F design?
Yeah, the hull bottom and the cross floors and everything were taken right off the J-2F line. And we signed the contract on the 14th of July in 1936. We made the first flight of the airplane on May 31st, 1937, delivered the first airplane, completely certificated, finished upholstered and everything to Wilton Lloyd Smith on the 3rd of July, 1937.
Day after Amelia was lost.
It was really?
July 3rd, 1937. July 2nd, 1937.
July 2nd.
Which was a Friday, so you made the delivery on a Saturday then.
That could be. We delivered it to the beach over at Lloyd's Neck and Mr. Wilton Lloyd Smith.
That's an interesting thing.
That's an all-time record, I think, for certification and completely finishing an airplane. We did not run structural load tests on the wings and tail surfaces on that airplane. We ran a typical Navy zero-lift dive test with the 4.5G pullout. Bob Hall did that particular test with no parachute because there was no way to get out of it.
No use being uncomfortable. If you got to go comfortable. That's it. Then what other air projects do you particularly remember?
Well, in September of 1943, Roy Grumman and Bob Hall, who was chief engineer, experimental engineering, and I went to England on a so-called Navy jet mission, where we were to be indoctrinated in the jet engines that were being built in England and the jet airplanes that they were starting to build with the objective of Grumman producing a jet-powered fighter to be active in the Navy fleet in 1945. We've had about 4 weeks trip where we went to all the factories and the air stations. And Bob Hall and I, while we were there, flew a Focke-Wulf 190 fighter that they had at Farnborough. They had captured from the Germans, and they had the German backpack parachute. Oh. And Bob and I were both terribly impressed with that airplane. And Roy Grumman sat on the wing and made sketches while Bob Hall and I measured the cockpit. Nothing was adjustable in that airplane. It had a backpack chute and a fixed rudder pedal. The controls were all electrically operated. The trim tabs and everything were electrically operated. You played it like an organ, and you couldn't open the canopy in flight. If you wanted to bail out, you had a shotgun that ejected the canopy so you could then get out of the airplane. But it was a terrific airplane. You just felt like you had wings strapped on you. So when we came back from there, I was given the job of trying to put together this the pieces that would make this jet fighter for us. And the most important thing was the engine. We were assigned a Westinghouse experimental engine. And I can recall taking the Grumman Goose and going down to Philadelphia, south of the airport, landing at the Westinghouse factory there. And then deciding that that engine would never be ready for at least 3 or 4 years. We came back and we designed the Grumman F-8F, which met the performance specifications that the Navy had given us for the jet-powered airplane. But we did this. If you look at an F-8F and look at a Focke-Wulf 190, you'll see a great resemblance in those two airplanes.
That's amazing. I guess we're being called.
Okay. We just had a lovely dinner, and we interrupted for about 40 minutes. That is now 10 minutes after 8, and my compliments to the chef. Betty, we were talking, last I can remember, is that Amelia, after her transatlantic flight, you saw her and GP occasionally socially, but mostly just various aviation meetings of one sort or another. On special aviation occasions, you would get together. And did you consider yourself to be a good friend of Amelia's at that time, or a good an acquaintance, or how would you characterize your relationship during those years of 1932,
34, 35? I would say I had the feeling that Amelia liked me. Whether you put that in the classification of friend or acquaintance or what.
When she saw you, you felt she liked you.
Yeah, I had the feeling she liked it. When she made it a point to invite us to come to meet somebody and so forth, come over to Rye, I felt that she... We weren't... You know, what is a friend? A friend is somebody you tell all your troubles to, and they tell you their troubles and all this kind of thing. That's not the kind of relationship that we had. But we were both interested in the same thing and members of the same organization. I think Bud Amelia and always enjoyed talking to Bud, and we just really like each other.
Do you remember when she flew across solo across the Atlantic?
Yeah, I remember. And you know, I cut clippings out of the paper at that time, but I gave them to the 99s for their scrapbook. I don't have any of the any scraps from those flights because I collected them and I gave them to the 99s. 99s have quite a scrapbook on Amelia at the headquarters in Oklahoma City.
You know, I mentioned this to either you or Thon, I don't remember which, but the scrapbooks at Purdue could use some attention.
At Purdue?
They have hers,
Amelia's.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They need some attention. They're starting to come apart and whatnot. The researchers going through them and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They need someone to go back and paste in the things again or somehow preserve them.
Cover them with plastic or some plasticize them or something.
Something like that. Because there won't be too many more years and it'll already start coming apart. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was leading somewhere. Where was I going? Okay, and did you get any feeling of the relationship between Amelia and GP as far as?
No, that I saw them together quite a few times, and they were both polite to each other, and everything seemed to be all right. I never heard any arguments or any unpleasantness.
Amelia, did she have a reputation as being a professional rather than a popular public reputation, a professional critique between pilots? Did she have any particular reputation amongst her peers as a pilot?
Well, I think she was very much admired as a pilot. I never heard anything but admiration.
Did she have any particular strengths or weaknesses as a pilot?
Well, I certainly wouldn't know.
You had, there wasn't any, well, that was all right, but did you see that takeoff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Have you ever seen anybody bounce so many times every time she lands or anything? No comments.
No, I never
She was
any.
Respected then amongst her peers as a competent pilot.
I would certainly say so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Was there any jealousies over her that you know of particularly over her recognition that she received, the public recognition that she received as a pilot?
Oh, it was competition. There were several girls competing for what Amelia was striving for, too. I mean, there's no question about that. Ruth Nichols had gave it her all and probably almost her life and cracked up and was seriously injured. And Amy Mollison, of course, her story is tremendous. Well, at that time, there was a lot of competition, but I never heard anything, any jealousy expressed. And probably they must have felt some jealousy or at least felt envy or something, or awe or something, and the fact that Amelia did accomplish what she accomplished, but no, I never heard any bitterness or anything of that kind.
Well, you know, let me stay up there with that for a moment. Did you remember going to see any of the ticker tape parade in 1932, or go down and listen to Jimmy Walker welcome her on the steps of City Hall in New York when she came back?
No, I didn't, and I don't know why I didn't. I don't know what I was involved with, probably raising a family. That would be, let's see, I had wee ones at that point. So.
All right, excuse me, would you tell me when your children were born and what their names are?
My son was born in 32.
What day of 32, remember?
December... He checked me December 13th,
1932. Pat was born in June
8th, 1934. Well, I know why you didn't really love him. You were very, very, very pregnant.
What's your son's name?
Peter. And then we had a third little girl who died of leukemia when she was 4, and that was Barbara. And she was born July
7th.
37?
July of 37, yeah.
July of 37. July 21, I think it was.
You delivered the G21, and she delivered the bond.
I went out this big pregnant, so big pregnant that I couldn't get the stick back, to watch him make his flight on the G21. I was in a Fairchild 24, as I recall, and I could hardly get the stick back. It was right before.
Well, now, he remembers delivering the airplane to Long Island, the first one, on July 3rd, which is the day after Delia was lost. And then you say that on the 7th, your baby was born. Mm-hmm. Well, now I can see why a lot of this would behave, because you had your own thing.
You know, I was doing my own thing. I remember
when all this was so big.
Yeah, I remember anxiously waiting for news. Was there any trace and whatnot? That's about all I can.
Did you see Amelia within the year before the flight that you remember?
Oh, probably, but I wouldn't be too sure. I wouldn't tell you what day or when. But I
was. She was back in New York. In January. In fact, I think she entered the Bendix earlier in 36 that year. She entered the Electra in the Bendix in 36.
Taking off from Floyd Bennett Field.
Yes, taking off.
We were over there that night.
Did you go over that night?
Yeah.
And she had some kind of difficulties.
Wasn't that the same one that Louise and Blanche were in?
Yes. Yeah. And wait a minute. Her co-pilot was... the girl that was going to fly, flew co-pilot for on that, in the Bendix, was going to. Something happened. That escapes me from the world. But you
can
were
you
over
remember?
There that night.
Where?
Who was flying co-pilot for Amelia?
Where?
Out of on the Bendix, out of Floyd Bennett.
I know who it is. I just can't remember.
I can't think.
There was a story about some sort of part or something they needed real bad. You went out to.
I remember there was a part they needed real bad. There was something that they needed real bad. Can't you remember what it was?
Nope.
Yeah,
I have it on record.
Oh, yeah.
Tapes. I just have to dig it out. Well, then you went over to see the airplanes and mm-hmm. see some of the people. That was in 36. Was it common knowledge amongst her peers that she was going to use the Electra to make a trip around, fly around the world, even before she publicly announced it?
Elgin, I don't know. I don't know.
You know, no woman had ever flown around the world
with
a pilot previous to that. Do you know, or have you ever? Did you ever have any reason to ever believe that she was doing anything besides just being the first woman to fly around the world?
You mean as far as the stories of her spy act? Oh, I haven't believed a word of that. No, that's ridiculous.
Or anything?
No. I think she had. I think Amelia was motivated by the same thing that Lindbergh was motivated by. Not just in his flight across the Atlantic, but in the rest of the flying that he did, and opening airways around the world, in northern routes and so forth. I think that Amelia had the same yen to do the same thing. And she made flights to Mexico, she made them all over. She was trying to push out the horizons for general transport aviation, and I think that I think her temperament and Lindbergh's are very much the same.
I gather two things, though, about Amelia's personality that I'd like to talk to you for a moment about. One thing is...
Bud is a lip reader.
Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. There's two things, areas of Amelia's personality that I would like to investigate with you both a little bit. One, when Amelia was deeply disappointed in something, she never really acknowledged it. She just went on about her thing. For instance, when, I can't remember who the girl's name, but there was a young lady about 1936 who wanted to be a pilot for one of the airlines, whether it was TAT or who it was, I don't really know. But she was hired as a pilot.
Helen Ritchie.
I'm sorry.
Helen Ritchie.
I believe that may be right. And the Airline Pilots Association wouldn't allow her in or something. Anyway, she was definitely being discriminated against because of her sex. And I have a lot of correspondence or telegrams and whatnot, and between Amelia and Helen, and telling Helen, okay, you know, you want to fight? I'll come right with you, and I'll fight side by side with you, and we'll fight this thing out if you want to fight. And unfortunately, I don't know that it was Helen Ritchie by name. I don't remember.
Well, Helen was the first girl to fly, to be hired by an airline.
Penn Central Airlines.
Penn Central Airlines. And she was hired as a co-pilot. But she couldn't get into the club, and they wouldn't let her, if the flight was an instrument flight, they wouldn't let her go out on it. I mean, they were holding her down in every possible way.
And Amelia was ready, and probably with the 99s behind her, I'm not sure of that, but was ready to really go to bat and fight it out.
Yeah,
she did. But the last minute, she backed off and said, no, I guess not.
I don't think she backed off. I mean,
well, she didn't continue the fight. She just quit. Now, I may have the wrong girl, because I don't think this ever got very far, because I only picked it up in the correspondence between Amelia and this girl, whoever it was. This 1936?
Yeah,
you're speaking
of? Helen.
Must have been Helen. But I have a indications in the correspondence that Amelia was very disappointed that she wouldn't stand up and fight it out.
Well, you mean that Helen wouldn't fight it
yes.
out? Oh, I thought you meant that Amelia
yeah, no,
had
Helen
dropped
was,
it. No, oh. Well, maybe.
Helen
wasn't very much of a fighter. She's a great person. She really was terrific. She went over and flew with the ATA at the beginning of the war when Jackie took that first group over. And then as soon as the WASP was organized, she came back. And she came back qualified as heck, a terrific pilot, and had flown the British fighters and everything, and Carcon made her go through Sweetwater complete before they let her get into a ferry command squadron. Now, Helen was pretty burned up about that, but we finally got her in ferry command. She was stationed at Wilmington. She brought back next to me in the same barracks that we lived in. And she was a terrific girl. She went out of the service and got a job selling stockings at Lord and Taylor's, and then she finally took her own life.
Oh,
she wasn't anything further for her.
About when was that?
Well, we got out in 45, didn't we? And then she went to New York in 46, probably about 47. We went there on that time. And she was a terrific gal.
That's
but
good.
She never got recognized as having been qualified to be a to fly on transfer, commercial airlines, they call them now. And they never did give her a break.
Well,
so I think she probably did give up. She probably had so much unpleasantness going on and, you know, male chauvinism. She just decided it wasn't worth it.
Well, I know Amelia was ready to stand right beside her and put all of her resources and fight
yeah.
with her. Mm-hmm. And now whether she talked this over with other 99s or not, I don't know. But I do know that when she got a cablegram from Helen said no, she was going to resign, it you know, bothered Amelia a lot. But she never mentioned, never mentioned one word of it anywhere, so anything again. I mean, she just done with it. That was it. Off to something else. She never bothered her. Never heard her. She never said a bad word. She never wrote a bad thing about some girls who you know, give up in the middle of the fight or anything. Never anything like that, which seemed to be characteristic of the media. Some pretty terrible mistakes were made at various times by people who were associated with the media. She would not have any recriminations against them, but by the same token, she wouldn't have anything more to do with them. But she wouldn't make a fuss over it. She just closed the door and go on her way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that at all? Or?
No, I don't, because I just never particularly had any incidents like that. But I would imagine, I think that's true of anybody that has a long-range goal. They can't take the time to moan over something that isn't working exactly right. You just go ahead and go right on.
Now, you say someone who has a long-range goal. Do you think Amelia had a long-range
goal? Oh, yes. I think her goal was, as I think, in the same way that Lindbergh's was, to get aviation spread out and establish routes. And no, she had confidence that airplanes would do these things, and so did Lindbergh. So did a lot of other people at that time.
And had the vision to see where it would all work.
That's right.
Okay, now there's another something that's a little more controversial. And this is almost my own personal observation. You may need to comment if you don't want it. But Amelia needed help. She needed help from people like Bud for advice, from people like Paul Mantz for advice, from all sorts of people.
Mm-hmm.
And she sometimes needed financial help. And sometimes she would need specialized help. Now this seems to be my observation. This trait goes clear back practically to her childhood. In fact, it goes clear back to her childhood. When Amelia wanted to do something or accomplish something or learn something or have something done for her, she would accept the help from almost any place that she could get it. And she would cater for that help, so to speak. But when she didn't need that help or assistance anymore, she would go on about her business, and what was behind her was behind her. She never looked back. I can give you what seems to me like example after example of this, where she would accept assistance from someone and whatnot, but would not stay in contact with that person afterwards, after the assistance was given. And after she was on to other things, she was just too busy to be looking back, so it seemed. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I understand what you say. I wouldn't have any feeling one way or another, because she never asked for my assistance on anything. So.
Did you ever? You probably had more contact with a lot of people that were in a position to help Amelia.
I think that's a very normal kind of a trait, though, Eldon.
For someone who's a doer, yes, because it's pretty hard to get things done otherwise if you keep spending all your time behind you.
But
and she did lead a lot of different kinds of help.
As an example of this,
go ahead, I can hear.
Oh, okay. Just as an example of this, Ken Royer. Do you know Ken at all?
Ken
Royer, R-O-Y-E-R?
No.
He lives in Huntington Beach. He's an older gentleman now. Ken was very infatuated with Amelia back about 1924, while she was living out here in Los Angeles. And Amelia, did she ever tell you about the Yellow Peril, you know, the old, about the yellow roadster automobile she had?
Mm-hmm.
See, the observation I get from listening to these conversations is she never talked about herself personally. She just, to anybody that she was involved with at the time, you really did not know anything about her past or anything about people she'd been involved with before.
Mm-hmm.
She kept her ahead.
She was thinking ahead.
And she kept her personal life very much
completely
to herself. Is that correct?
I would say very much so.
Very much so.
You really didn't. You knew her, and you knew her very well, but there were a lot of areas in her life you never touched on.
And she didn't touch on ours either,
yeah,
because our conversations didn't run that way.
Yeah. See, that's kind of strange, though, because you knew her for over a period of quite a few years,
mm-hmm,
actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of strange that at no time during that period of time did you get involved in her personal life at all.
But it isn't just strange to you.
Well, probably if we hadn't all been in aviation, and we would have had to find some other subject to talk about, it might have been different. But there always seemed, at that time particularly, plenty. You could sit all evening, you know, all day and all night, all weekend, and talk aviation. In fact, it used to drive my family crazy because I couldn't talk anything else. And my sisters always said about Bud that she couldn't stand him. Why didn't I educate him to talk something besides aviation? That's just the way it went.
It'll be exciting,
you know?
And I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, but this, you know, the strange part of this is that you, as two friends of Amelia during a period of her life, never knew anything about her previous life at all. But what's strange is I've interviewed people throughout her entire life, and nobody
exactly
in her life
way
ever knew anything about her previous life.
She was such
she
good friends with certain.
Friends.
She'd be good friends with period people with a certain period of time, and then when she was on to the next thing, they almost totally lose contact with her.
Mm-hmm.
She never sent Christmas cards. She never wrote letters to old acquaintances.
How about Louise Thaden, for instance? Didn't Louise have pretty continuous communication with her?
Not really.
No.
Not really. Amelia very seldom wrote letters, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
GP did most of the correspondence. She occasionally wrote letters and notes and whatnot. She sent a lot of telegrams. But Louise knew nothing about Amelia personally either, until Amelia showed up in 1928. You ask Louise any question you want about Amelia in 1928, she can't tell you a single thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Amelia never talked about anything behind her.
Also, another thing.
And it's very hard for me to cross-reference things. I never get any cross-reference. I only get out of people who knew her at one time, and they don't know anything yet,
mm-hmm,
forward or backwards about her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get quite a composite picture, but unfortunately.
Well, isn't this true of almost everybody you know, unless you sit down with a tape recorder like that and make them probe back into their minds and dates? You wouldn't know. You and I, four of us, might have dinner together, meet at shows and everywhere, and you wouldn't know anything about whether I had four children or eight children or 12 grandchildren.
That
or
wouldn't be true of me.
You wouldn't know anything.
No, I would know your whole life history before the evening
you
was
would
out. That absolutely would not be true of me. If you were to characterize me, I would be the opposite.
Uh-huh. Well, you're gregarious. Gregarious. Interested
loves,
in
she
people.
She just loves people.
Uh-huh.
I'm glad I'm a people so she can love me.
You see, now we still don't know anything about your background.
Well,
we've been talking about ours all this
time.
I got my tape recorder out and start working on you.
Well, it is kind of.
It's just an interesting sidelight that we notice as we do all the interviewing, and it doesn't matter. If a person fit into this time slot in there in her life, that's where they fit. Then the next one fit in the next time slot, and the next one fit in the next. And there's no interconnections to speak of.
That is very strange, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, when you do it over a period of 5, 6, 7 years, and you interview several hundred people, and there's very little interconnection,
mm-hmm,
then you begin to wonder why, you know, she has to have been certainly a very one-minded person. I mean, all her thought must have been out here.
In one direction, but she did change over the years from social work and whatnot.
Yeah, but she
sense
still was dedicated to future always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, she went through various phases in her life, and social work was a
short
phase, a short one. It was very short, actually. By the way, did you ever talk to me? You both had a common interest in medical.
Did you ever talk about her going to...
She went to Columbia for a year in pre-med.
I know she did. No, I would never talked about it.
Never talked about it. Mm-hmm. See, now, that, I find that very strange, if you were good friends, that you never discussed...
Your interest in medicine, she said.
Well, I don't think that we ever were alone in a room. Let's say that, let's put it this way, there was always somebody else. It might have been GP, or it might have been another 99, or Grover, or somebody, and you don't get into that kind of a conversation.
Well, do you then, maybe, can you say that she really had no really close personal women friends as she went along?
I don't think she did.
I can find no evidence.
No,
that she did.
I don't think she did. I don't think she had that kind of a temperament. Which is, I mean, there are a lot of people that way.
Well, you know, she has two very distinct characters if you study her, if you go into her. Mm-hmm. She has this very sweet, very likable, very, but she's also got a very determined, deep down push. And they kind of don't go together usually.
I would think that you get to see Faye Wells, that Faye might be able to give you, to tie those two personalities of Amelia together. Because Faye knew her very well.
Did Faye know her pretty well as a person, you think?
I think so.
Did you ever remember ever talking to me about the Round the World flight at all? About the Electra?
I don't know.
How about you, Bud? Did Amelia ever talk to you about the Electra before she bought it, or about anything besides her antenna?
The only time I recall talking to her about it was after she had had the accident and it was being rebuilt in Miami.
Do either one of you remember her secretary, or GP's secretary, really, in New York, Betty? She died of cancer about 1942, but she worked for AE and Amelia and GP in their office. They had an office there on 52nd Street, right near Grand Central Station, up on the 15th floor. They had an office there. What was her name? She was married.
You ever remember going to that office?
No, I don't think I remember.
Or be aware of it, particularly?
I don't recall ever going to their office or meeting the gal.
You know, they never, when the house burnt down at Rye, they lived in hotels whenever they came to New York after that. Mm-hmm. They always either lived at the, anyway, they lived at one hotel for about a year or so, and then they got moved over to another hotel. And then they always lived at one hotel or the other, which gives you some idea of the family lifestyle of her and GP. Because both of the boys, George and David, stayed with Benny after the divorce. And she took them down to Florida, and they more or less raised them. Until Amelia got started with Boston and Maine Airways. And then David was old enough then, and he took over and worked at one of their stations up in Bangor, Maine. Worked for them as one of their agents at Bangor, Maine. But they lived in hotels, and she was on the lecture circuit.
Yeah, she was.
Did you ever hear her speak?
Yeah, I heard her speak. Mm-hmm.
What did you think of her as a lecturer?
Oh, it was excellent. I've heard her speak to 99 groups, but not having heard her speak in great.
Ever heard her speak to a woman's group in particular?
But only the 99s. Mm-hmm. Or I've heard her speak at dinners. I've been trying to think now. I remember how Mrs. Roosevelt was there. I remember shaking hands with Mrs. Roosevelt. She handed me a wet fish. Oh, can't remember what it was. What was the occasion? But I know Amelia was on one side of Mrs. Roosevelt, and I was on the other. Amelia was the speaker. It must have been while she was president, I guess.
Must have been what?
While she was president of the 99s. for the Rock of Legends or something. Have you ever interviewed Jackie Cochran?
We would like to be able to get to her. How do you get to her?
No, I haven't. I have three or four things I would really like to talk to Jacqueline Cochran about.
She claimed to know Amelia so very well, you know. She even said, writes in her book about having extra perception, and
that
when Amelia was lost, she knew how to find her and where to find her and all that sort of thing. Just wondered.
I've run into these things. Putnam sent a cablegram to the Chief of Naval Operations on the 14th of July, 12 days after the crash, and requested that they search at a location of 0 degrees latitude, 9 minutes north and 170 degrees east. And because of he didn't say what exactly it was, but it was obvious it was because of a seance. And Jacqueline mentions it in her book, Stars at Noon. Mm-hmm. And the Navy refused to change their search plan because they only had 2 more days of fuel and whatnot to continue the search, and they thought it better to continue with their plan and cover the areas than to have to make a special probe in that area. And the interesting thing is, which I find fascinating, but you know, it doesn't matter, but well, with what we know about drift rates of life rafts on water and what we know of the winds and currents in that area now, that particular location would be almost in the middle of a footprint of where the life raft would have been on the 14th of July if there had been a raft and if it had been floating for those 12 days. Isn't that interesting?
That kind of stuff gives me the creepy jibbies.
And, of course, I'm interested because I know that Floyd, or Jacqueline, but it's listed as Floyd Odom on the income tax, gave them $5,000 to help originally on the flight. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money in 1936. And I know that after the crash, Floyd gave them another $5,000 to help put the airplane back together again. These are reported on the income tax. The other thing I would like to find out about is what Amelia, see, she went out there with Terry Mance and spent a few days at the ranch just before the flight. And I would like to know what conversation Jacqueline can remember. And I'd like to know what Jacqueline's thoughts and anything.
You can't get through.
Oh, I haven't really tried. I've been afraid to.
You better hurry.
Well, I know that.
Yeah, she's in pretty bad shape.
I wanted to ask you something, but I'm not interested. You know, I don't want to get past 1937, but with a cutoff date around 1937, Jacqueline was in competition with Amelia in many, many ways, I would think, as you know, as was Blanche Noyes and other girls that you mentioned. Who were, you know, prominent women pilots and competing in the Bendixes and competing in their air races and for world records and these things. And yet here Jacqueline is.
I don't think Jackie was ever in competition with Amelia.
Wasn't directly in competition with her?
Jackie didn't love to fly.
She didn't love to fly? Well, here she is through her husband giving her $10,000 to be the first woman pilot to fly around the world. That doesn't sound too much like jealousy. Sounds like good sportsmanship in a way. I don't know. I can't quite understand.
No, but she just didn't go out and compete with the women.
Jackie wouldn't compete against any woman.
She
entered the Bendix, and if another woman entered, she'd pull out. She'd never be beaten by a woman. This was a principle of Jackie's, very definitely. We went to visit Jackie one time years ago, Teddy Kenyon, and I went to the ranch. And who was the man that was teaching her navigation for the Bendix? Who did her flight planning for? Anyway, we got there, and he came out to the car to meet us. He said, "Now look, Jackie will ask you to play croquet. Please let her win."
Jackie will not be beaten by any woman. And this was right through her life. She would never enter the Powder Puff Derby, the Transcontinental Air Race, any event that had a woman in it. And she entered several Bendixes. When the women entered, she withdrew. She never was raced against a woman.
She would name an alternate pilot for the Bendix race and decide at the last minute whether she'd go or the alternate would go. And I don't, you know, Jackie has accomplished great things and all, but she's that kind of a person.
You can't be top if somebody beats you.
I admire the hell out of her for some of the flying she's done, because in my opinion, she was not a natural pilot. She was uptight and tense and
nervous wreck. She had to go to the hospital
I was amongst the official starters at several of the Bendix races and all, and I remember at Van Nuys talking to her before the start of the race there, and it was all planned out, and she would climb at such and such a speed for so many minutes and such a course and all, and that's the way she'd fly it. If she was told to do it, then that was, you know, it made sense to her.